Well, it looks like we're at the top of the hour. Thank you all for joining. Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Ribbons, and I am with TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. I would like to welcome you to today's call, which is titled Endocrine Disrupting Activity Associated with Oil and Natural Gas Extraction. Our moderator today will be Carol Kwiatkowski, TEDx's Executive Director. Our speaker has provided slides to accompany her presentation, and the link to download them was emailed to everyone who registered for the call. If you still need to download the slides, you can do so now from our website at tedx.org. On the homepage, click on the link in the What's New box on the right-hand side, which says Teleconference Call on Oil and Gas. This will take you to the call page. Once on the call page, you can click on the link to download the slides. This call is scheduled for 30 minutes with time at the end of the call for questions. Due to the high number of participants on the call, if you have a question or comment, we ask that you post these to our live chat. You can access the live chat by going to the call page and clicking on the link provided. Please note that a password is not required, so just leave that field blank. We will be monitoring all of the comments and questions throughout the call, and we'll read questions to the speaker after her presentation. Right now, everyone has been muted with the exception of our moderator and our speaker. And as I noted, the call will last 30 minutes, and it is being recorded. With that, I'm going to hand things over to you, Carol.
Thank you, Chris. I'd like to welcome everyone to this TEDx call highlighting new research on endocrine disruption and unconventional natural gas development. We're so pleased to be able to provide this service that directly connects scientists with people from academia, government, healthcare, and the general public. Today, I'm very happy to introduce Dr. Susan Nagel. Dr. Nagel is an associate professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and women's health at the University of Missouri School of Medicine. She specializes in the role of natural and synthetic hormones in development, reproduction, and disease. Dr. Nagel has published several articles on hormone receptor activities of hydraulic fracturing chemicals and surface and groundwater, and continues to study endocrine disruption in areas heavily impacted by natural gas development. So with that, thank you very much, Dr. Nagel. We're looking forward to your presentation, and you can take it from here.
Thanks, Carol, and thanks very much for having me. As Carol said, I am an associate professor in obstetrics, gynecology, and women's health, and I have a research lab in our department. So just on the first slide, I just would like to thank our funders, so the NIH, the University of Missouri, and EPA. Next slide. There are many potential routes of contamination of surface and groundwater with oil and gas chemicals, and particularly the wastewater. So this is just a cartoon and a photo illustrating some of those points. Next slide highlights what types of contamination we might expect. We might expect contamination from wastewater spills, runoff, leaks, volatilization into the air, casing failure, deep connectivity, and also direct disposal into surface water. Because of this, we initially asked the question, can chemicals used in unconventional oil and gas operations disrupt normal endocrine signals? And I did move to the next slide. So we're going to look at that first one briefly. So what do I mean? So hormones are part of the endocrine system. They are chemical messages that are essential for normal health and development. They're really what gets the work done and communicates throughout the body. Next slide. Hormones work by binding to specific receptors. So you can think of it as a lock and key analogy. So hormones need to bind to a very specific receptor, just like a lock needs to accept a very specific key to open. Now sometimes you can put a key in a lock and it won't open, and it will prevent the normal key from functioning. And this is a lot of what we'll be talking about today with blocking normal hormone receptor interactions. So endocrine disrupting chemicals, next slide, are defined by the Endocrine Society as a chemical or a mixture of chemicals that interferes with any aspect of hormone action. And it's very important to note that hormones work at very low concentrations. Therefore, endocrine disrupting chemicals can also work at relatively low concentrations by blocking the normal action of hormones. We initially asked the question, can chemicals used in unconventional oil and gas disrupt normal hormone signals? So here is a list on the next slide of 23 chemicals that we tested for disruption of 5 different types of hormone receptors. On the next slide, the results of these studies that have been previously published are summarized. We list 5 receptors, estrogen, androgen, progesterone, glucocorticoid, and thyroid. We measured the ability in human tissue culture cells of the 23 chemicals to either activate those receptors or inhibit the normal action of those receptors. What we found was that many of these chemicals could inhibit estrogen and androgen receptors. About half could inhibit progesterone and glucocorticoid, and about 7 out of 23 could inhibit thyroid hormone receptor. Next slide. Disruption of hormones is associated with human disease. So we measured those chemicals to disrupt hormone receptors. So we might expect then that disruption of those receptors could result in human disease. And this is just a graphic to illustrate the point of the extreme interconnectivity of all of these hormone receptors with normal health and disease. And all of the aspects listed on the right have been studied in the laboratory by ourselves and others. I've highlighted there infertility, and I see that I highlighted neurological issues, and I meant to highlight reproductive problems. So those are what we're going to focus on next. So next slide. We wanted to ask the question, is there evidence of an association between oil and gas activities and human reproduction in the published literature? That is, what else has been done on this topic? This study was just published this summer. A systematic review of the association between oil and natural gas extraction processes and human reproduction. And I highlight there oil and natural gas extraction because we did not limit this review to unconventional oil and natural gas, but all types of oil and natural gas extraction. We also limited it to studies that dealt with human reproduction. Summarized in the next slide is our research strategy, our search strategy for the literature. I highlighted there that 1,814 studies met our initial search criteria, which is published, that included oil and gas and a very long list of words associated with reproduction. Next, 442 of those original studies related to oil and gas extraction. 63 of those related to oil and gas and human reproduction. And 45 were related to oil and gas, human reproduction, and were original research studies. So what did we find? I want to take you through how we integrated the evidence from these 45 studies in the next slide. So what I have shown you here is a pie chart of how we're going to talk about the integration of the evidence. So on the right is that pie chart. Above each pie chart, we'll have an endpoint that we questioned, and and below each pie chart, the total number of studies that we found. Now, to integrate the evidence, we assessed, using OHAT guidelines, several factors related to the quality of the study, risk of bias, and other factors, and subsequently rated each study as either having an effect with high confidence, an effect with moderate, an effect with low. On the contrary, there were studies that had no effect. We didn't have any studies that had no effect that were related, that were termed high confidence. We did have studies that were no effect moderate and no effect low. So those in blue found an effect, and those in shades of orange or yellow did not find an effect. The more intense the color, the higher the confidence in the study. So moving to the next slide, we wanted to assess birth outcomes associated with oil and gas activities. So the first shown here are miscarriage and stillbirth. So for miscarriage, we found high and moderate evidence for an effect on miscarriage. So that is an increased risk of miscarriage, with a total number of 3 studies. There were a total of 2 studies related to stillbirth that found no effect, and these were rated with relatively low confidence. Therefore, no conclusions can be drawn. Next slide. Preterm birth and low birth weight. These were the most conflicting endpoints that we found. You can see that the majority of the studies had some effect. Interestingly, though, some studies showed a decrease in preterm birth or low birth weight, and some showed an increase. Some of these studies were relatively high in confidence and that found an effect. These, we think, are related to the design of the study as to whether they had an effect and how many factors they took into consideration. With this, I think it really speaks to the need for rigorous epidemiological studies for these endpoints. Next slide. Looking at birth defects, there were 3 studies that found an effect with moderate confidence, and there were 2 studies with sex ratio that showed conflicting results. Next slide looked at male reproductive health outcomes associated with oil and gas activities. There were a total of 4 studies, or a combination of 4, that showed an effect on semen quality and fertility in males. 2 studies looked at birth outcomes associated with paternal exposure to oil and gas activities. 1 found an effect and 1 did not. Finally, prostate cancer. There were several studies with moderate confidence that found an association between prostate cancer and oil and gas activities. For all of these that I have just mentioned, these were either residential exposure or occupational exposure. Next slide. This slide is slightly different. It looks at the ability of oil and gas activities to disrupt endocrine receptors. So not unlike what we did up above, and in fact, our studies are included in these pie charts. So additional studies were found that looked at the ability to disrupt estrogen, androgen, and progesterone receptors. The vast majority of these studies found that oil and gas, wastewater in particular, and also isolated chemicals can disrupt endocrine receptors. Moving on to what health effects may be associated with prenatal exposure to chemicals. And in this particular part of the talk, I'm going to be focusing on work that we have done in our laboratory and not the entire breadth of health effects that might be associated. So fetal and early life exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals is associated with adult disease. This is what we have primarily focused on our research efforts in our lab. Chris Kasotis, when he was a graduate student, made a mixture of 23 of those oil and gas chemicals that I previously showed you that he studied for their ability to disrupt endocrine receptors. Shown on this slide are the 23 chemicals. He made a mixture and then administered them in the drinking water of pregnant mice. On the next slide, and I am on slide 23, I realize I did not keep saying to advance. This summarizes his exposure paradigm. So mice that were pregnant were given the mixture of chemicals in their drinking water from day 11 of pregnancy to birth. The vehicle that we used to administer the chemicals was 0.2% ethanol, and you can see that there were 4 different treatment groups ranging from 3,000 micrograms per kilogram of each chemical down to 3 micrograms per kilogram. Now, this exposure window is roughly equivalent to the second trimester of human pregnancy, and this is important because it's a limited exposure. First, we looked at the ability of prenatal exposure to alter the number of pups born, and this, what is summarized here, is the pups per litter in the next slide, 24. We didn't see an effect of this particular exposure on the number of pups per litter. So what health effects did we see? In the next slide, we will shift our attention specifically to male offspring. In the next slide, I have summarized just a couple of endpoints that I'm going to present to you today. These are all published, and I want to just focus your attention on a few and get to some of your questions. So we found that the body weight of the animals whose mothers were exposed to the mixture of oil and gas chemicals, some of them had increased body weight, and this is at weaning, at postnatal day 21. Now, to talk about, to put these exposures into context, the lowest two doses we feel may be a realistic environmental exposure level based on our research and others. Those highlighted in blue are concentrations that might be expected from based on research of groundwater concentrations at sites that had had a spill related to the wastewater of oil and gas. The highest concentration highlighted there in orange is those that we might expect to be found in wastewater. We also saw enlarged heart weights at weaning in these male mice. Next slide. Prenatal exposure tended to increase adult testosterone and decrease sperm counts. So we saw at the highest concentration a increase in testosterone, and at several of the medium concentrations, we saw a decrease in adult sperm counts. Shifting our attention to what health effects did we find in female offspring? So I am on slide 29. Prenatal exposure decreased reproductive hormones, particularly prolactin and FSH. These are pituitary hormones that are essential for normal reproduction. So these results are looking in adulthood at about 3 months of age. All of the doses that we tested suppressed prolactin, and most of the doses suppressed FSH. Next slide. Most of the doses also decreased LH, which is a pituitary hormone also necessary for reproduction. Interestingly, the middle dose increased growth hormone in these adult females. This is just a tiny snapshot of one look in slide 31 of the follicles in adult females. And so these are what are involved, one tiny part of what's involved in normal production of oocytes to be made available for fertilization and subsequent reproduction. So looking at this particular type of follicle, so this is an atretic follicle, and this is a normal process of where cells, the follicles, die, and as specific ones are recruited for ovulation. What we saw was an increase at those lowest two doses in the number of atretic follicles compared to the vehicle-treated mice. On the far right there, I have not mentioned the flutamide group, and this is one sort of positive control. It is a known anti-androgen, meaning it blocks the normal action of androgen receptor. In slide 32, we also looked at the hearts of these offspring. We had seen some evidence of disruption in the heart of male siblings, so we wanted to look at the females. This is an analysis of collagen deposition. What we saw was an increase in that medium dose and a tendency at the lowest dose. What this suggests is an increase potentially in how hard the heart had to work and possibly damage. We were also very interested in this because of Lisa McKenzie and John Adgate's study that had found increases in the risk of congenital heart defects in those babies whose mothers lived closer to oil and gas activities in Colorado. So in conclusion, many of the chemicals used in and produced by oil and gas activities can be endocrine disrupting chemicals. Our systematic review of published studies suggests there's evidence for an association between oil and gas activities and negative developmental and reproductive health effects in humans. Our laboratory studies found an association between prenatal exposure to oil and gas chemicals, and negative developmental and reproductive health outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nagel. That was very interesting and extremely helpful to those of us who have been following the literature to see how you summarized it and how you've moved forward in your most recent studies and publications. And I would remind people that you can put questions in to our chat line on the call page. And I do have one question that is actually related to a question I was going to ask, so I'm going to combine them. And this is about your systematic review. We've watched these kind of conflicting results that have come out over the years in the birth outcomes. And you mentioned that we need stronger epidemiological research in order to resolve some of the conflicting evidence there. And I wondered if you wanted to expand on that a little bit, talk maybe about, you could dive into that a little bit more, talk about other solutions or other ways of getting a handle on the evidence. For example, Joe Rochester submitted a question and asked if you thought about doing meta-analysis on the data. And then a question also sort of a follow-up to those questions is, is anyone doing this type of research and following up on these very critical needs that you've identified?
Great. Great question. The meta-analysis would be an outstanding approach. To date, there are still not very many studies. A meta-analysis would then combine mathematically a systematic review of those particular outcomes. Of course, there are limitations, and I am not an expert in meta-analyses, but there are limitations in the sense of how the studies are conducted and how easily they are collapsible into that type of analysis. Certainly, some of the studies that have been done most recently that took into exquisite consideration many factors related to potential exposure, those studies did find an association, and I think that is the type of study that we need. So these studies looked at the volume of wastewater of potentially produced near pregnant women, just a whole list of the activities related to oil and gas that some of the other studies did not.
Great, that's very helpful. And we have other questions coming in, and I will read them to you. One from Linda Roberts, she asks, what were the group sizes, the number of litters used in the studies, and is postnatal data based upon individual selected pups from each litter or combined per litter values?
Great. We had 10 to 11 litters in the studies that I presented today. All of the data from weanlings, so at 3 weeks of age, was from one mouse per litter. And then in adulthood, sometimes that was more than one mouse per litter, so two-ish, really. And in that case, then, we incorporated litter in our mixed linear model of statistical analysis.
Very good. Thank you. Another question from Kimber Houdeshell. Are all the birth weight studies on low birth weight, or were some of the reporting small for gestational age? And of the studies reporting continuous data, what were the conclusions for human health effects?
That's a great question. Some did use small for gestational age as opposed to the looser low birth weight, but not all. And let's see, the second part of that question
was other studies reporting continuous data, what were the conclusions for human health effects?
Right. I don't have actually an analysis that separates out those that had a continuous data versus not.
Okay, no problem. Another question from Trevor Hadeshell. Did you conduct risk of bias on the in vitro studies of the hormone activities of the chemicals in the oil and gas production?
We did not.
Yes, I don't know if that was available when you were conducting your review. A question from Catherine. She says, what are your thoughts on the absence of dose response across your study? The 300 mixed dose seemed to be particularly inconsistent with findings regardless of endpoint.
Yeah, excellent question. Thanks so much for asking. So you say the absence of dose response. So we do have many non-monotonic dose responses. So this is very characteristic of endocrine disruption during development. So we think of some mechanisms that are related to the fact that as you increase the dose, you don't necessarily increase the severity of one specific endpoint. So some of those are related to potentially, we have not tested any of them yet, but potentially they are related to mother's metabolism of the chemicals. And then just looking at the individual endpoints, we have, depending on the receptor and the tissue that is changed, as we increase the concentration, we can actually downregulate receptors and have no effect in some cases with larger doses than at lower doses.
Yes, very interesting and characteristic of endocrine disruptors. Another question for the future, are you continuing research with oil and gas, and what's next on your docket?
We are. We have ongoing studies in the lab right now where we're looking at some of the potential metabolic consequences from developmental exposure, and also in particular looking at behavior after developmental exposure to some of these chemicals.
Well, those sound like very interesting studies indeed. That's all the questions we have at this point, and I wonder if there's anything you'd like to add, Dr. Nagel, that you maybe didn't present, or if you had any more comments from the questions before we close the call.
I do not.
Well, good. That was a lot of information. It was very clearly and succinctly presented. We do have one more question, and it's a good one to end on. Can you help us understand what your data means in the context of human health risk implications?
Yes, I can try. So, particularly for looking at developmental exposure, where some of the consequences can be long-term and also permanent, I think it is potentially prudent to try to reduce one's exposure particularly during pregnancy and early life. And while I say that, I certainly realize that the data are limited still, and that that is out of some people's the realm of a possibility. But I do think that is one interpretation of the human health risks.
Yes, thank you. The precautionary principle is always a help, easily translated to better safe than sorry. So I think with that, I'll thank you once again, Dr. Nagel, for your presentation, and people can download your studies from our website, and I will turn the call over to Chris Ribbons to close.
Thank you, Carol. I want to make sure that everyone knows that there will be an MP3 recording of this call available on our website soon, and we encourage you to share it with others. I would like to thank everyone for participating in our call today. We hope to be hosting more calls in the future, and we'll send out emails to let you know about them. We also have recordings of previous calls on our website that we would encourage you to listen to the recordings if you were not able to join the calls. Again, I would like to thank Dr. Nagel for taking the time to present her research, Carol, our moderator, and thank you to all of the participants for taking the time out of your day to join us. I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day.